Thursday, October 24th, 2024. From Peachfish Productions, it's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. The United States is finally getting with the realities of air travel in 2024, the aforementioned year. Smoking on flights was banned in the 1980s. This was thanks to congressional legislation and stewardesses coming home smelling like a pack of Luckies. Back then, we could say stewardesses. We could all say, ugh, you smell terrible. By the 1990s, almost all of Europe followed suit, banning smoking. Cigarette-happy China even banned smoking in the 1990s, but with one exception. Pilots could still smoke. Smoking in the cockpits was allowed. I mean, they're not maniacs over there in China. How do you expect a person to operate a 787 Dreamliner if he's not able to take a drag on a Marlboro while working the controls? But in 2019, an Air China pilot was vaping, thus triggering an alarm, thus causing a loss of cabin pressure, and even China got on board after that. But there is one relic of this time, those pesky no-smoking lights. The pilot has turned on the no-smoking light. And do you know why the pilots turned that on? Because it's not 1987. But finally, the FAA changed the rule. And now you no longer have to put up with the turning on and the turning off and someone telling you that you can't smoke. That's right, you can't do something that everyone whose birth postdates the Roosevelt administration assumed you couldn't do in the first place. And if you're wondering if I'm being sarcastic, I meant Teddy. And then finally, they did away with the no smoking lights, except they didn't. I will read from the executive summary of the FAA document reconsidering the rule, because the entire rule took 7 pages. Currently, crew members must be able to manually turn aircraft no-smoking signs on and off. This requirement was implemented prior to the prohibition on smoking in passenger cabins during all phases of flight. It goes on, as a general matter, there is no longer a need for the signs to indicate two different states of smoking permissibility, because smoking is not typically permitted on any or most transport category aircraft. This direct final rule provides more flexibility by allowing no-smoking signs to be illuminated continuously. To be illuminated continuously. So there will still be no smoking signs, but, and here's the innovation, they will always be in the on position. So they will light up too, I guess. Why not just paint these signs? Or even better, you know, you save 20 bucks on the 5-watt light bulbs above every seat. Why not? This is the crazy one. I'm going to throw this out there. Why not just do away with the requirement for a sign anyway? We don't have no bear baiting signs, no murdering the guy next to you signs, even if he takes off his shoes and socks. No, you can't smoke on an airplane. But yes, somehow the best we could do is not to eliminate the sign to that effect, but just to permanently set it to on. What is next, good sir? Shall you tell me I can no longer fill my Stutz Bearcat with its preferred leaded gasoline, or as I call it, gasoline? That's right. No smoking. Also, not allowed on aircraft. No filleting of woolly mammoths. No onboard lawn darts. No fomenting a coup in Upper Volta. All are true, but the only one that needs to be stated is no smoking. It is ever so illuminating. Literally, you can't shut it off. And that has been a sign of the times. Who's that? Sorry, sir. You just ended your segment with a treacly pun last heard when Skip Stevenson hosted Real People. Yeah, but I'm doing the whole snow smoke. No, you're going to have to come with me, sir. Okay. But let me first say, on the show today, I spiel about why people might be voting for Donald Trump. But first, wait, hold on. I'm coming. But first, I have to say that Fred Kaplan has won a Pulitzer Prize. He writes the War Stories column for Slate. He co-wrote books with General Petraeus. He's been a New York Times bestseller, but never a novelist. His new book is called A Capital Calamity. And I was talking to someone who has read the book yesterday, and he said, it's a real page-turner. This is true. It's kind of fun. Also true. You can't put it down. I felt I couldn't either. Now, I have to say, the guy told me this is in the book, but that aside, it's a fun read. And Fred is a very knowledgeable guy. Fred Kaplan, up next. Joining me now is Fred Kaplan. He's been on the show before. He's a Pulitzer Prize winner, a New York Times bestselling author. But that's because he knows about war, and that's because he knows about nuclear weapons. He was on to talk about the bomb. The bomb informs his latest work, which is a novel. It is called A Capital Calamity. And the cover shows a mushroom cloud over the dome of the Capitol. Yes, it is about annihilation. We're going to talk about world events and the book and being a novelist. Fred, welcome back to The Gist.
Good to be here.
Do you like writing? Do you like writing? A lot of writers hate writing. Like a lot of journalists hate writing.
People say, oh, it's like, you know, putting a needle in my vein and letting the blood. I think that's bullshit. Come on. Writing, it's work. Sometimes it's hard, but come on. I mean, we're not out there digging ditches or selling insurance. I mean, it's a privileged life.
Right. That's true. And you have to say it, but you do mean it. I'm not gainsaying that, but there are a lot of writers that their enjoyment or they think that what their real skill is sussing out the information. But then when it comes to putting it on the page, that's the least enjoyable part of it. Although I would think as a novelist, you might be different.
But I've always considered myself a writer.
First.
Yeah. Yep. Well, I don't know about first, but I mean, I've been a journalist for a long, long time, but I'm very pleased when somebody says, hey, I liked that turn of phrase.
Yeah.
Maybe even more than, hey, how'd you find that out?
Yeah.
You know?
Or that analysis was spot on.
Yeah.
But,
I like both of those things, but yeah.
So is the motivation for this book that you wanted to convey to us, the reader, some analyses that, I mean, there's so many facts in the book, but you wanted to convey some analyses that didn't quite fit in with any of your fora that you currently have? So, I mean, it's a fun novel. The plot is good. The characters are really interesting. But also, I have some stray ideas. And if I don't write a novel, I don't know if they're going to go anywhere.
Well, that's part of it. The prosaic reason is, you know, my last book that came out, The Bomb, came out weeks before lockdown. A few months into it, I felt like writing another book. The way I write books, I research by going to do face-to-face interviews and archival libraries, because not everything is online. There's a lot of things you need to go to libraries.
Yeah.
And I couldn't do that.
Especially with the eras you write about, a lot of Cold War stuff. Yeah.
So I couldn't do that, obviously. And I'd had this idea for the beginnings of a novel many, many years ago. So I revisited it. But basically, I have a lot. You know, I've been in the quote-unquote national security biz for 40-some years. I've observed a lot of characters, anecdotes, incidents, ambiance. Not enough to like write a memoir or a coherent, but enough like I'm going to write a novel that I'll plug all this stuff into.
And you worked for Les Aspin, right?
For 2 years, a long, long time
ago. This guy, Willoughby, in the book has a similar background. He went to MIT too, so did you.
Yeah, we have some things in common. The character Serge Willoughby.
Named Serge, first name because?
Well, see, I had this idea a long time ago because he grew up the scion of some nice Midwestern kids who went to the University of Wisconsin to study American history and got so turned off by what they saw of American imperialism that they joined an anarcho-syndicalist commune where all of the kids are named after leftist heroes. He was named after Victor Serge, Memoirs of a Revolutionary. Some of his good friends and growing up were Marx, Kovacs, and Lenin, Henderson, who later became, hedge fund capitalist. So he goes off to MIT. That's his form of rebellion, becomes a mathematician and an arms control guy. He goes to work on the Hill and discovers to his great disillusionment that he does all these brilliant analyses, but people vote the way they want to, having nothing to do with the analysis.
Right.
So he becomes a cynical defense consultant. It's a story of the moral arc of a disillusioned man who returns to principles and discovers that what happens in the beginning of the book. So I'm not giving anything away. He's at this party of the defense community, which I describe in very colorful terms. And the host is a guy that he hates for a variety of reasons. And so he decides, he's heard, I won't go into the whole story, but basically he goes up and does something on his telephone that makes it a good possibility that the guy will be called by the FBI.
Yeah.
And he ends up getting arrested. And because of this, a war starts between the United States and China. And he realizes he has to get in and stop this war. And he has to team up, and he's never fought
for anything.
Because
the war is an opportunity for him.
Well, but still, he understands
yeah.
something has gone amiss here. He can be mischievous, but he doesn't. The opening line is, Serge Willoughby just wanted to make money and have fun. He didn't mean to start World War III.
Right.
So he realized, holy shit, I've started World War III, and he has to stop it. And in the course of doing so, he has to come to grips with the concepts of responsibility and purpose, which he has been evading for a variety of reasons for most of his life.
Do you think this is how humans actually change their mind, or just very convenient for characters in a novel? I shouldn't say convenient, very compelling.
I mean, I think it depends. I think,
well, think about people who've changed their mind. Think about George Conway, right?
Well, I think, listen, there are plenty of conservatives who have changed their mind looking at Trump.
Yes.
Now, there are some people, and I'll mention, he's a friend of mine, and we used not to agree on very much, but like a guy like Max Boot. Max Boot realizes what's going on with Trump and then sees a lot of fallacies in his positions on all kinds of things. Max Boot is practically a liberal these days.
Yeah.
You know, he has a very mixed opinion biography of what used to be his towering hero, Ronald Reagan. I think there are crises in life that do change people. And I think we're seeing in today's political environment, a lot of people, especially among conservatives, I think, coming to grips with, well, where do I draw the line here?
Mm-hmm.
What is the proper thing to do? And not just, what'll be best for my tax bill, or what'll be best for the regulations around the business that I own, or whatever, but about the country.
Yeah,
I think we're seeing quite a lot of that these days.
I don't know if the prime examples of the people we think of who had come to Jesus or come against Trump moment, if they're great examples of someone following their convictions at the at personal cost. Because I'm not sure, but I think Boot probably has more followers than he did before. I don't know, maybe he lost gigs at magazines. I think about George Conway. He was firmly ensconced in the conservative establishment, but now he's at least has a bigger public profile. Jennifer Rubin, I think, revitalized her career.
Yeah.
Liz Cheney, I don't know. She probably paid some costs, but
point is, she lost her seat. She lost her leadership role. She
lost
everything.
She did. She paid some political
costs. And I don't think she's
going to
become a Democratic leader now, even if she wanted to.
No, but I think with Cheney, the problem for her was because she has more conviction than 90% of the Republican caucus is, I couldn't live with myself. And so the question is, does that make you a good person? I think it makes you like the de minimis person that we
Well, maybe.
Need.
I mean, and you know, as we, I won't go into the ending of the story, but as we leave our hero, Serge Willoughby, he's just beginning his transition.
Yeah.
Into does it mean to be a responsible citizen, which is a question that he'd always thought was bullshit before.
Yeah.
He thought that the Washington was completely a game, completely made up of cynics. And to a large extent, that is true. But there are moments when it's important to rise to the occasion.
So this, as a book about nuclear annihilation and calamity and catastrophe.
But it's also a comedy.
Sure, of course, the funny one, you know.
Yeah.
It's Dr. Strangelove updated with Peter Sellers being much less flamboyant and over the top. But are you familiar with the concept of P-Doom?
P-Doom.
Have you heard of this?
No.
Probability of doom. So a lot of the...
Okay, well, I've heard of that. But...
Right. So they express it as P-Doom. What is your people who are gamblers or Nate Silver talks about it a lot, but so does the altruistic, effective altruistic community. This is a huge mm-hmm. thing among effective altruists.
Yeah, yeah.
What's your PDUM?
You know, it's so crazy. You know, these kinds of questions are nonsense. Because let's say I'm right.
I think you're right.
Let's say I'm right.
Yeah.
Who gives a shit? After we're doomsday, nobody's around to collect
the bet.
Also,
what's the difference between 0.15 and 0.35? How do you change your policies?
It's like Nate Silver's models of the chance of who wins an election.
Yeah.
Number one, I think it's nonsense. Number one, most people get it confused. They think that a 60-40 probabilities is a 60-40 margin. Second, it has no predictive value at all. In 2016, he said Trump had a 30% chance of winning.
Right.
Trump won.
Yeah.
Because what are you talking about? He goes, well, yeah, I said it was a 30% chance.
Oh, well, that has a great predictive value.
Yeah.
Everyone was saying 10%,
no,
he says 30.
No, everybody was saying 90, but he said 30.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. If everyone was saying Trump had a 10%, he was saying 30, you bet on that. Nate says that people come up to him all the time saying, I made so much money because you opened my eyes as to the real possibility of Trump. But you're also
right.
But,
I mean, the point is you...
When everything's 45-55, it could be
it could
totally
be anything.
Wrong. Yes, yes. I want to ask you a couple questions that have occurred to me over the last few weeks or months. And I said, ooh, got to ask Fred this. And I knew you were coming in. You covered Star Wars, the Strategic mm-hmm. Defense Initiative. Is what we're seeing with the Iron Dome and the anti-missile defense, is that related? Is that an outgrowth of Star Wars?
No,
nothing
not
to do
at
with
all.
It.
When Trump says, we should get Iron Dome. We have Iron Dome. We have stuff like Iron Dome has a range of about 40 miles.
Yes.
Which is what you need in defending Israel from...
Right. Well, then they have other David Sling.
They have other things. Yeah. But I mean, the point is, if you're talking about defending the United States mm-hmm. from strategic missiles fired by Russia or China,
which
intercontinental
is SDI.
Ballistic missiles,
yeah.
That's a much more complicated task, and it's never been tested. This thing has been around for no... You know that we have still yet to even test an SDI anti-missile interceptor against two warheads fired at the same time?
Why not?
Because it won't work.
Right. Because I saw John Podhoretz of commentary saying that the effectiveness of Israeli defense forces offers some vindication for the Iron Dome.
No.
For the SDI.
Not at all.
Not at all.
We've had this in turn. We've had the Patriot. We've had all kinds of surface-to-air missiles that can do exactly the same thing at even longer range.
Mm-hmm.
We are not in short supply.
Well, is it impossible for SDI? Nothing's impossible, but does the effectiveness of Patriots shooting down Scuds or whatever, does it have anything to say about people who are like, we have to scrap SDI because it can't work? Because I'll just put this on the table. I often find that the people who are activists or most motivated by a missile system or being against a missile system sometimes confuse the is-ought distinction.
Mm-hmm.
And they say, we shouldn't have this because this will incentivize more buildup of missile. And also it can't work. The things we shouldn't have are also things that could never work. And I question that.
Well, I would say this. We're spending about $10 billion a year on this. And have for quite a while. And
really? That, to this day?
Yeah.
Yeah, SDI.
Yeah. And that's ignoring the more short defense against short and medium range missiles, which, you know, that's a different program. Those are within the Air Force or whatever.
And those ones work.
This is just a missile defense. Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, it is amazing that even though the test is rigged and that the people operating the interceptors know that it's coming and where it's coming from, and it's just one-on-one, it is kind of amazing that you can fire. It's hitting a bullet with a bullet.
Mm-hmm.
That's extraordinary. It's a technical feat that's extraordinary. Does that mean that 10 bullets can hit 10 other bullets fired within minutes of each other?
Right.
I don't know. Never tried it. And why is that? Well, because it probably wouldn't work. But the other thing is, now, if you have SDI, and okay, yeah, keep trying it, whatever, and then some limits on offensive arms,
mm-hmm.
then okay. But, you know, the wheels, the brakes are starting to come off nuclear arms control treaties. And if there's not going to be treaties limiting the number of offensive weapons, then the best way to counter, let's say that you, and you tend to do this, you tend to believe that the other side's stuff works. So let's say Russia or China, they're looking at what they need to do to do a first strike or whatever, and they're counting up the number of interceptors that we have. And they say, okay, well, I just have to fire that number plus one. And so they'll get more warheads. And in fact, nobody quite knows why China has suddenly started to build up its nuclear force. The opacity is much thicker than it used to be among people involved in nuclear policy in China. But one possible reason might be that they believe in American missile defense and they need to build more warheads to allow for some of their stuff to get shot down on the way.
So the Nobel Prize was just given to a Japanese group that keeps alive and talks about the effects of the 1945 bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Now, if you asked, and you know these people, and you wrote books about these people and have been in the archive, if you went back 79, 78, 77 years, forecast them to 2024 and told them that will be the last use of a nuclear weapon, would they have been surprised?
I've in fact asked people this who are, I mean, for example, I'll give you an example. Dan Ellsberg, who, you know, before he became an anti-war activist and anti-nuclear, he was a Cold War hawk.
Right.
He worked at the Rand Corporation.
This is why he had the visibility.
And when he joined the Rand Corporation in 1960, he was 29 years old, and Rand offered a very generous life insurance policy. And he didn't take it. And another guy who was also 29 didn't take it.
And that's called a revealed preference by economics.
Yes,
that's
because,
money where your mouth
because
is.
Because he figured, I'm not going to be around to collect this. I'm going to die in a nuclear war. And I asked him, not long before he died, I said, you know, thinking back in 1960, same question you had. If I came to you from the future and said, hey, Dan, I'm from the year 2023. Not a single nuclear weapon has been used in war since 1960, quite aside from the fact of the plausibility of someone coming at you from the future, what odds would you give to the idea that for the next 60 years, 65 years, nobody's going to use a nuclear weapon? And he said, close to zero.
Mm-hmm.
It was believed that there would be a war with the Soviet Union, and that as a result of various things, at some point, pretty early on, this war is going to go nuclear.
Yeah. So what does that say about expertise in general? Did we just get lucky?
Well, I mean, I don't know if it says anything about expertise in general.
I mean, if your job is to be a traffic engineer, you see traffic accidents all the time, right?
Yeah, but and this you is know, why we've only seen two nuclear weapons used in war ever.
Right.
So calamitous. Well, I think you can infer two things from this case.
Yeah.
One, there's something to nuclear deterrence. You know, just in the most basic terms, you clobber me, I'm going to clobber you.
Daniel Ellsberg saved us. He was right.
So that's one thing. But the other thing is there's a lot of luck. There have been times when, the radar is showing 150 missiles coming our way. Okay, it turned out to be a flock of geese or a computer error. There's been more of these incidents than you might think. Luckily, except for one occasion, nothing tense was going on in the world. And so it just wasn't believed. The one case where it was during 1983 and the Russians were actually expecting a first strike, and there was warning of like 150 ICBMs, which is kind of crazy for a first strike when it's against 1,000 targets. And there was basically the equivalent of a lieutenant colonel.
Do you remember his name?
You know, I don't.
It's in the book, right on the shelf.
Book,
yeah. He's like the greatest hero in world history. We don't remember his name.
He decided that he wasn't going to pass this one up to the superiors.
Yeah.
Which he should have done. He was acting very insubordinate. And he said, no, I don't believe this is really happening. And he didn't. And so as a result, we're all still living and breathing.
So I just looked it up. Let us toast to Stanislav Petrov.
Petrov. Lieutenant Colonel Petrov.
Yes.
Yeah.
The greatest human in history.
Yeah.
And if you want to hear more of Fred Kaplan, and really, who doesn't? I have a few ways that you could do that. On Saturday at 6 p.m., he'll be in Washington, D.C., Politics and Prose, but the Union Market branch. So perhaps you could pick up some crudité. Is that the kind of market Union Market is? Let's say it is, but press the flesh with Fred. I don't know if he's germaphobe, but 6 p.m. Saturday or on Tuesday, October 29th, he'll be in Brooklyn at the Community Bookstore on 7th Avenue. That'd be Tuesday, October 29th, 7 p.m., Community Bookstore in Brooklyn. Or if you don't want to spend your money on an Acela to D.C., or perhaps if you live in D.C., an Acela to Brooklyn, or even the Uber over to these events if you're in those towns where he's appearing, go to Pesca Plus, because we have more of Fred Kaplan, the fascinating Fred Kaplan. Pesca Plus is a way to get bonus segments. It's also a way to eliminate the ads for $8.99 a month or $89 a year. You get excellent bonus segments that don't require you to go to a market in a town that isn't even in a state. Or for $4.99 a month, just listen to the program ad-free at subscribe.mikepesca.com. And Union Market and Community Bookstore, in this particular case with Fred Kaplan, but also subscribe.mikepesca.com. And now the spiel. I was just on Andy Mills' show, Reflector, or will be on Andy Mills' show. We taped it today, but it's going to air in a couple days. So I will now reflect, or possibly preflect, on a imperfect question and answer that I gave about a question I've talked about on The Gist, and one that you've probably been hearing if you're looking at the polls, and perhaps your soul. How is it that Donald Trump is, can we say, on the verge of victory? It's pretty close. How did we get to this place? What are we missing? Now, the very fact that this question can be asked in a divided country, and you probably hear this question a lot more than the opposite question, how is it that Kamala Harris could be elected president? And there are some precincts where you might hear that question as well. But the fact that this question is so in the air, and it seems so unfathomable, tells you a lot about the answer. So as I said on the show, the question is posed by the type of person who might not be addicted to MSNBC, but certainly can name four hosts and might not have a subscription to the New York Times, but is more likely to see something that was printed or covered in the New York Times than they are to see something that was covered on the Doughboys podcast or the Gateway Pundit or even some totally non-political or news-making media. The kind of person who wonders, how could it be, is, I think, asking the right questions, and they're like me. They've come to the right conclusions. I don't actually wonder how it could be, but I sympathize with the sentiment that is animating the question and the direness of the question, which is, this guy has disqualified himself so many times over. And without stepping on the explanations, and the explanations are mostly, I think this is the big explanation, is that he's always been popular among Republicans. The Republican nominee is always going to get 45-ish percent of the vote. And here's the big thing. We're in an anti-incumbent mood the world over. Macron and Trudeau and the Prime Minister of Japan and incumbent parties have lost from Senegal to South Korea. One huge reason is that inflation, which hit the world after the pandemic, is really, really upsetting to people, legitimately upsetting to people. Now, if you're the kind of person who listens to The Gist or maybe does watch a bit of MSNBC, you probably know the answers to that. And the answers can be a little overstated, which is something like, it's nothing about what the Biden-Harris administration did. I think that it's a little bit about overstimulating the economy when it was already stimulated. But that's okay. Most of it isn't what the Biden-Harris administration did. If it was about what the Biden-Harris administration did, inflation wouldn't have been over 10% in the UK. It was under. It never got to 10% in the United States. But, you know, if you look at Canada, second Canadian reference of the day, inflation was lower there, and they didn't have the stimulus that the United States did. So there was something to the stimulus. If inflation got to almost 10%, you know, 9.8%, I'd say at least 1.8% of that, of the worst of that, was stimulus that the Democrats were behind. But it's mostly about a war in Ukraine, and it's mostly about supply chains. But really, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. This is politics. This is how people think. People who don't delve into all the minutia or even some of the minutia of the four legal cases and the January 6th hearings. People who just want to live their lives, and if they vote, are saying, are things going better now or were things better then? And they could come to their conclusions however they come to their conclusions. But in general, and not just Americans, and not just Americans who are, quote, racist, or Americans who are experience are epistemically challenged by the news that's fed to them. People the world over hate incumbents because their lives have gotten worse and inflation was a part of it. And the pandemic caused a lot of that. But people, voters, this is how democracies work. They're not entirely forgiving. In fact, and I do say this on the show, maybe the better question, given the unpopularity of the incumbent party and the fact that I guess you can't blame Joe Biden because he's not on the ballot, but maybe you can blame Kamala Harris because she's not doing an effective job of separating herself from Joe Biden. But given the basics of how unpopular the president is and how wrong track people think the country is, and don't be so myopic, New York Times reader, I could reach you on that point. Given this huge trend the world over, it's kind of amazing that Donald Trump very well could lose. You know, just generic Republicans should have a pretty huge advantage over Kamala Harris or whoever the symbol of the current administration is. But the other thing, and I don't get into this too much on Reflector, but upon reflecting or preflecting on Reflector, I think about where this question is coming from. And this question is coming from us, you and me, and my friend Andy on Reflector, and the sort of person who would ask this question probably listens to a little Pod Save America, but also engages in so many activities that not just the average American, but the median 50 to 75% of Americans don't engage in. And we think it's normal. We live a life that's very removed from the middle 25 to 75, or I would even say 20 to 80% of most Americans with our college degrees or advanced college degrees, with our preference for television shows that not only do we think are good, like Succession, but we kind of get obsessed over that 90% of the country has never watched, with our eating preferences, how we'd never eat mayonnaise. We might eat an aioli, but we wouldn't cop to liking mayonnaise, whereas in 80-something percent of the country, of course they're putting mayonnaise on that. This is America, and mayonnaise is delicious. In 80-something percent of the country, they don't know the difference between the New Yorker and New York Magazine, and we all do. So we might know this about us, and maybe we have family members that we feel connected to or people we grew up with that we feel connected to, but don't you find yourself, when you talk to them, not always making these same assumptions that they'll have the same cultural references as you do? I'm not talking about, you know, they might like a band and you might like a band, or you both might like Katy Perry, you might like Bon Iver, and they might like, I don't know, a band that people actually like, Luke Bryan. But you do find yourself, I'm not going to say censoring, but crafting your message to the people that you have connections to, who you don't look down on, but family members who are more, if you are of this ilk, family members who are more in the middle 80%, or friends who you grew up with who are more in the middle 80%. And that's just it. They're like most people and you're not, or the kind of person, there are a lot of people who are listening to the gist who are saying, I'm a mayonnaise-eating Bon Iver hater. In fact, I don't even think that's how you pronounce Bon Iver. Isn't it Bon Iver? That guy's just mope rock. Can't stand that. And don't get me started on the Tame Impala. But the very fact that there is this disconnect, most of the people asking the question, how could it be, are not in the middle, are outside the middle, looking at the middle, saying, how'd this happen? There was another story in the New York Times today, which, by the way, great newspaper. I don't criticize it. But it was about fascism and how this historian, this fascism expert, who's 90, has now come to believe that we're in a state of potential fascism or that Donald Trump's a fascist. Big story, got a lot of play, stark picture of the guy's face. And this is so very much a concept that drives the non-middle 80%. This is so very much something that is so outside the awareness or the interest of almost everyone in the country, though the New York Times, I think, probably had this passed around a lot. This guy, a 90-year-old named Robert Paxton used to not think that we were in a state of fascism. Surely you remember that when Robert Paxton was a mere 83-year-old, he wrote that we should hesitate before applying this most toxic of labels. And as you needn't remind your mayonnaise-loving friend, he wrote this, and I'll quote for the New York Times, in a column for a French newspaper republished in early 17 in Harper's Magazine. So yes, of course, everyone's waiting on if Robert Paxton has decreed that we are now in a state of fascism, which is a man-made label applied to a subjective situation. But that's the sort of thing that we, Aeoli Americans, listen to and say, this is important. This factors in how could anyone vote for this guy? And the data point that factored in, I'm not going to say it's not real. Some 90-year-old changed his mind. Were we really paying that much attention when he was 83? I guess if we read that French newspaper, we were. But it's the accretion of these little details that really don't affect the lives of most Americans. So if it's inexplicable how we're here, I'm trying to explicate it. I'm trying to preflect on the explanation. People have concerns, ideas, information, a little bit of information, priorities, far different from the average person asking, how is it possible that anyone would be voting for Trump? And it's odd to ask this question. What it is expressing a very strong opinion about democracy. Democracy's in peril. How can anyone vote for him? So expressing this strong opinion that implies you're out to save democracy, but also showing at the same time you don't understand democracy. You might understand it as a concept, but you're not in touch with the will of your fellow voter, which is to say the fundament of democracy. It's like as if a cancer expert asked for the explanation. So how do these cancer cells form? Sir, it must be the devil's will. There are issues out there that people care about. How will it affect my life? Inflation is one. I'm told that home affordability is another. That's a weird issue, though, when you think about it, because unlike inflation, where some guy somewhere is making money off of you, we're the ones, the homeowners are also voters. There are more voters who are homeowners than not, and they're the ones making the money, or at least accruing the wealth based on home inaffordability. It's not like homeowners are some cartels. They're just American citizens who own homes that have appreciated in value. So that's a weird kind of issue, maybe perhaps a little bit overblown. I was thinking that it was a little bit like people who were upset about milk affordability also own all the cows. But will Donald Trump win? I don't know. I have made the case that when you really think about it and take the Trumpiness out, he kind of should win, or the person in that position should win. The person who's the embodiment of the anti-incumbent in this moment, pretty much everywhere in the world. And if he does win, I would say that what's going to happen is that people will blame the media for not explaining hard enough and long enough how wrong everyone to vote for him was to vote for him. But I say if you're going to do that, just what you should really do is cut out the middleman, the scapegoat of the media, and just blame democracy. Because what democracy does is it allows everyone to vote. And to be very fair, Trump, a threat to democracy, though he is, on the more generalized level, being so disconnected from your fellow people, so much so that you can't possibly understand how they make these decisions. I don't know if it's a threat to democracy. The word I've been using is it's a disconnect from democracy. And all of this would be true, and it would be a much stronger argument if it were the case that if there were no Electoral College, Kamala Harris would probably win. In other words, if you actually did go with the actual will of all the people, yeah, then we would wonder, how could most of them really like Donald Trump? That's it for today's show. Corey Wara is the producer of The Gist. Joel Patterson's the senior producer. Michelle Pesca is the CBSO of Peachfish Productions. Leo Baum was here interning, doing what he does. Umpru, Jeepru, Dupru. Thanks for listening.